The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. Rudolf Hess, a remarkable figure of 20th century history who was Hitler's deputy during the Third Reich, was recently in the news, even though he's been dead for 24 years. Last week, under cover of darkness, his mortal remains were dug up from his gravesite in a small town in southern Germany, taken away, and secretly cremated, with the ashes later strewn over the ocean. This secretive and shameful act was carried out because local and national German officials have been unhappy that Hess's gravesite has become a shrine, a center of pilgrimage for large and growing numbers of people from many countries, but above all for patriotic Germans, especially younger Germans, who respect their nation's heritage and honor its great leaders. Rudolf Hess was born in Alexandria, Egypt, in 1894, the son of a German businessman who was living and working in the Egyptian city. Rudolf Hess's mother was of Greek origin and ancestry. Hess had a good education, and in addition to German, he spoke both English and French. During World War I, he proved himself a brave and courageous soldier. As an infantryman, he fought in major battles and was wounded several times. For his courage and valor, he was awarded the Iron Cross, second class. He rose to the rank of lieutenant, and during the war's final weeks, he trained and served as a pilot. After the end of the war, Hess was a student at the University of Munich, where he studied history, political science, economics, and geopolitics. By the way, it was during the 1970s that I was myself a student for two semesters at that same university. Hess's first contact with Hitler came in 1920 when he heard the young fellow veteran speak at a public meeting. From then on, he was devoted to the man who would have such an impact on Germany and the world. In November 1923, during the ill-fated attempt by the young National Socialist Movement to overthrow the Bavarian government, Hess commanded a battalion of stormtroopers. After Hitler was sentenced to prison, the loyal Hess, now 30 years old, voluntarily joined his friend behind bars. He served as Hitler's secretary and helped him to produce his book, Mein Kampf. He wrote down Hitler's views as he expressed them verbally, and he helped to edit and polish the transcript for publication. In the years of struggle and during the years of the Third Reich, Rudolf Hess was Hitler's deputy as leader of the National Socialist Party. His forthright but sympathetic character made a positive impression on everyone, including foreign leaders. Well, everything changed in 1941. On the evening of May 10th of that year, Deputy Führer Hess set out on a secret mission that was to be his last and most important. Under cover of darkness, Rudolf Hess took off in an unarmed Messerschmitt 110 fighter bomber from an airfield in southern Germany and headed across the North Sea toward Britain. His plan was to negotiate peace between Germany and Britain. 4 hours later, after successfully evading British anti-aircraft fire and a pursuing Spitfire airplane, Hess parachuted for the first time in his life and sprained his ankle landing in a Scottish farm field. An astonished farmer found the injured pilot and turned him over to the local Home Guard unit. Winston Churchill, who was Prime Minister at the time, promptly rejected Hess's peace offer and jailed him as a prisoner of war, even though Hess had arrived unarmed and of his own free will. Rudolf Hess, an ambassador of peace, was to remain a prisoner until his death in August 1987 at the age of 93. He spent 46 years, half his life, behind bars, a victim of a cruel victor's justice. More than any other man, Rudolf Hess symbolizes the vindictiveness and hypocrisy of the Nuremberg Tribunal. In September 1939, Hess was deeply shaken by Britain's declaration of war against Germany. And so, with Hitler's approval, he began a secret effort a few months later to negotiate a peace agreement between the two countries that he called fraternal Germanic nations. He made these efforts through British officials in neutral Portugal and Switzerland. When this endeavor failed, Hess began preparations for his flight to Britain, an unquestionably sincere, if perhaps naive, effort to end war between his beloved homeland and a nation he greatly admired. A few weeks after his May 1941 flight, Hess told a British official, quote, "My coming to England in this way is, as I realize, so unusual that nobody will easily understand it. I was confronted by a very hard decision. I do not think I could have arrived at my final choice, that is, to fly to Britain, unless I had continually kept before my eyes the vision of an endless line of children's coffins with weeping mothers behind them, both English and German, and another line of coffins of mothers with mourning children." Well, though there was little chance that Hess's mission could have succeeded, some aspects of his flight and its aftermath remain unclear. Sefton Delmer, who was the British head of wartime propaganda for British broadcasts to Germany during World War II, has speculated that the British government might have good reason for its secrecy regarding Hess and his flight. Sefton Delmar said, "At the time, Churchill published nothing about the Hess case. He was passed over in silence. There was a large peace party in Britain, and Churchill probably feared that this party would throw him from his ministerial seat because he had not agreed to Hess's peace proposals." Unquote. At the end of the war, Hess was taken to Nuremberg to be tried, along with other German leaders, by the United States, Britain, the Soviet Union, and France, as one of the so-called major war criminals. Although Hess was perhaps treated more unjustly than any other man on trial at Nuremberg, the tribunal itself was of dubious legal and moral standing. In fact, many prominent men in America and Europe pointed out that the Nuremberg trial process violated two cardinal principles of justice. First, the Nuremberg trial was a trial of victors against the vanquished. The former, the victors, were their own lawmaker, prosecutor, judge, alleged victim, and in part accomplice, that is, in the case of the Soviets in the division of Poland. And second, the charges for the Nuremberg trial defendants were invented for the occasion and defined after the fact. That is, the charges were ex post facto charges. Ex post facto charges and trials are specifically forbidden for Americans by the U.S. Constitution. U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Harlan Fiske Stone at the time called the trials a fraud. He wrote in a letter, Chief Justice, Chief U.S. Prosecutor Jackson is away conducting his high-grade lynching party in Nuremberg. I don't mind what he does to the Nazis, but I hate to see the pretense that he is running a court and proceeding according to common law. This is a little too sanctimonious a fraud to meet my old-fashioned ideas. Associate U.S. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas charged that the Allies were guilty of what he called substituting power for principle at Nuremberg. Douglas later also wrote, quote, I thought at the time and still think that the Nuremberg trials were unprincipled. Law was created ex post facto to suit the passion and clamor of the time, unquote. It was especially Soviet participation in the International Military Tribunal of Nuremberg that lent it the aura of a political show trial. In fact, Judge Nikochenko, the Soviet magistrate who presided at the solemn opening session, had been a judge at the infamous Moscow show trial of Zinoviev and Kamenev in 1936. Before the Nuremberg trial convened, Nikochenko explained forthrightly the Soviet view of the enterprise. Nikochenko said, quote, We are dealing here with the chief war criminals who have already been convicted and whose conviction has already been announced by both the Moscow and Crimea declarations by the heads of the Allied governments. The whole idea is to secure quick and just punishment for the crime, unquote. In other words, Nikochenko acknowledged that the Nuremberg trials were essentially a fraud because the victims were already, the defendants, had already been publicly declared to be guilty by the Allied leaders who set up the entire enterprise. Besides the tribunal's dubious legal standing, it held Hess and the other German leaders to a standard to which the Allies were never held. In sharp contrast to his public utterances, the chief U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg, Robert Jackson, privately acknowledged in a letter to President Truman that the Allies, here I'm quoting, have done or are doing some of the very things we are prosecuting the Germans for. The French are so violating the Geneva Convention in the treatment of German prisoners of war that our command is taking back prisoners sent to them for forced labor in France. We are prosecuting plunder, and our allies are practicing it. We say aggressive war is a crime, and one of our allies asserts sovereignty over the Baltic states based on no title except conquest. Well, nothing better points up the essential injustice of the Nuremberg process than the court's treatment of Rudolf Hess. He was in the dock primarily because of his important-sounding but somewhat hollow title of Deputy Führer. His duties as Hitler's stand-in were almost entirely ceremonial. He delivered the annual Christmas address to the nation. He welcomed delegations of ethnic Germans from abroad. He appeared at charitable functions. And he presented the Führer at the annual Nuremberg Party Congress. In fact, it's that image of the wide-eyed and ecstatic Hess that much of the world remembers best, most of all from a brief clip of him from the film by Leni Riefenstahl of the 1934 Congress, a film entitled Triumph of the Will. Hess was known as the conscience of the party. He often used what power and influence he had to intervene on behalf of victims of persecution by extremists in the government or in the party. An American historian who has looked at the Nuremberg case is Robert F. Conant, who's the author of a book entitled Justice at Nuremberg. His book is generally very critical of the German defendants. But nonetheless, historian Conant called Hess in his book a, quote, decent and honest man and a pacifist at heart. In their Nuremberg indictment of the Deputy Führer, the four Allied powers predictably portrayed him in the most sinister way possible. It charged in its indictment, quote, Hess began his conspiratorial activities immediately upon termination of World War I by joining militaristic and nationalistic organizations. The indictment went on to claim, rather absurdly, that, quote, Hess was one of the members of the Nazi conspiracy who professed as early as 1933 the aim of complete world domination, unquote. The joint Allied indictment of Hess concluded with the almost ludicrous words, quote, All through the years from 1920 to 1941, Hess remained the most faithful and relentless executor of Hitler's aims and designs. This complete devotion to the success of the conspiracy was climaxed by his flight in Scotland in an attempt to end the war with England and to receive English support for Germany's demands against Russia, which he had helped to prepare. This, the share of Hess's participation in the Nazi conspiracy, is as great as that of the party which he directed. The party's crimes are his. Unquote. In fact, one of the amazing and remarkable features of the Nuremberg trials is that it was not necessary for the Allied prosecutors to show that the defendants had individually or specifically carried out any crimes. It was only necessary to show that they were involved in what the prosecution called the conspiracy. In other words, in the case of Hess, merely the fact that he had been in as a member of the so-called conspiracy was enough to show his guilt, as shown by the quotation that I just presented. Well, in truth, the Allied case against Hess was objectively a very weak one. Hitler had kept his deputy rather in the dark about his foreign policy and military decisions. And at Nuremberg, it was clearly established that Hess had not been present at any of the meetings at which Hitler discussed his military plans. And, of course, Hess could not be held responsible for German actions that took place after his flight to Britain, including, of course, those carried out during the campaign against the Soviet Union, which began after Hess's flight to Britain. Today, all the same, the tribunal declared Hess guilty of, quote, crimes against peace, which it defined as planning and preparation of aggressive war. And it also found him guilty of conspiracy, quote-unquote, with other German leaders to commit alleged crimes. But the tribunal did find him innocent of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Well, this is incredible, because the Nuremberg tribunal found Hess guilty of crimes against peace, even though he is the only major figure of any of the governments involved in World War II who risk his life for peace, who actually risk his life to try to bring the war to an end. In fact, he had no role whatsoever in planning or preparation of aggressive war, and the claim of conspiracy was an utterly empty one made and invented by the Allied prosecution for the purpose of nailing the defendants whom they had already declared guilty. Today, no reputable historian believes that the Nuremberg charges of that Hess was guilty of crimes against peace have any validity. In fact, almost all of the criticism of Hess in recent years has focused instead on his signature on the 1935 Nuremberg Laws that stripped German Jews of their rights as full citizens and banned marriage and sexual relations between Jews and non-Jews. These Nuremberg Laws allegedly paved the way for the extermination of Jews several years later. Well, whatever the merits of this argument, and they're very weak actually, Hess had nothing to do with the drafting or promulgation of these laws, and his signature on them was completely pro forma. Even more to the point, these were domestic laws, domestic statutes in a country that had, and laws that had counterparts in numerous other countries, including the United States. In fact, one of the ironies and examples of hypocrisy or chutzpah in this case is that Hess is criticized for putting his signature on the Nuremberg Laws of 1935, even though in Israel today marriages are not permitted between Jews and non-Jews in Israel itself. And, especially ironic, and an example of hypocrisy, because for Orthodox Jews, marriage between Jews and non-Jews is impermissible anyway. So to that extent, the Nuremberg Laws were upholding behavior and tradition that Orthodox Jews are supposed to recognize and support anyway. Also amazingly, even though Hess is criticized for his signature on the Nuremberg Laws prohibiting marriage and sexual relations between Jews and non-Jews, by the way, Jews making up less than, about at that time, about 1% of the population of Germany, at the very same time, in the United States, the majority of states in the U.S. had laws prohibiting marriage between people of different races. In the United States, at the very time, 1935, of the Nuremberg Laws, laws in the United States affected and impacted far greater numbers of people, both proportionally as a part of the population and in absolute numbers, than the Nuremberg Laws did in prohibiting marriage between these different groups. In the U.S., laws in many states prohibited not only marriage between blacks and whites, but between Indians and whites, between Indians and blacks, between Asians and whites, and so forth. A further irony is to compare the sentence against Hess and the punishment of Hess and fellow defendant Albert Speer. Even though, as historians acknowledge and as the Nuremberg Tribunal indirectly confirmed, there was no evidence that Hess was involved in any wartime or war planning or aggressive measures or policies, fellow defendant Albert Speer, who did a great deal to prolong the war as armaments minister, was sentenced to only 20 years of imprisonment. But the big difference is between Hess and Speer in that Speer acknowledged his guilt or responsibility, and Hess refused to ingratiate himself with the tribunal. He expressed no remorse for his loyal support of Hitler and the National Socialist regime. And in his final statement to the court, Hess boldly declared, quote, "I had the privilege of working for many years of my life under the greatest son my nation has brought forth in its thousand-year history. Even if I could, I would not wish to expunge this time from my life. I am happy to know that I have done my duty toward my people, my duty as a German, as a National Socialist, as a loyal follower of my Führer. I regret nothing. No matter what people may do, one day I shall stand before the judgment seat of God eternal. I will answer to him, and I know that he will absolve me." Unquote. Well, given this, when it came time to decide his sentence, the judges were not inclined to deal leniently with such an unrepentant defendant. The Soviet judge and his alternate thought that Hess should be put to death. The British and American judges and the American and French alternates voted for life imprisonment. while the French judge suggested a sentence of 20 years. The British alternate abstained. And so the sentence against Rudolf Hess was a compromise. They settled on life imprisonment. Well, we'll take a break at this point and come back in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
This Iraqi man's son, 9-year-old Ali Kinani, was shot dead by private American war contractors 4 years ago.
His brain fell to the ground between my feet.
On the same day, dozens of other innocent Iraqis were shot by trigger-happy U.S. professional killers.
They shot like they were trying to kill everyone they could see.
No one at Blackwater, the firm for whom the hired guns worked, has been punished for the massacre. Two other private American security companies were contracted to carry out interrogations at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, a name synonymous now with horrific human rights violations, including torture, rape, and murder. The U.S. Supreme Court recently threw out a lawsuit alleging abuse of prisoners by the contractors. In Afghanistan, it's reported that human rights violations and even killings are committed by security firms on a regular basis, to an extent set to undermine coalition forces' counterinsurgency efforts.
They'll start firing at anything that moves. They'll injure or kill innocent Afghans, and they'll destroy property.
We're getting fairly consistent complaints about them. Everybody knows somebody who's been shot by the contractors.
The lack of accountability has forced the United Nations Working Group on Mercenaries to push for specific international measures to regulate their activities. Especially now, as U.S. military forces withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan, the number of contractors is set to grow dramatically.
U.S. government has outsourced many of the military and security functions to these private military and security companies. They are not regulated, and they are not controlled. And this is what we are extremely concerned at. What we are calling is for regulation at the national and at the international level, so that these companies are accountable.
But Washington is reluctant to let an international body regulate their activities, saying it will find ways to hold contractors accountable. But so far, the U.S. justice system has largely failed to do so.
We're seeing around the world cases of kidnapping, rape, murder, and we see very, very, only very rare cases in which there's actually a criminal investigation or a prosecution arising out of them.
Experts say further privatization of war is convenient for the American government because, among other reasons, it doesn't have to justify the deaths of troops at home.
The president, whoever the president may be, can get us involved in conflicts only using uniform forces to do the official fighting, and then thousands and thousands of contractors to do the unofficial fighting that's under the radar.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about the case of Rudolf Hess, and more specifically, how his treatment by the Nuremberg Tribunal, which was set up and organized by the victorious Allied powers and operated in 1945-1946, underscores the essential injustice and double standard of the tribunal. One of the most eminent British historians of the 20th century was Professor A.J.P. Taylor, who is the author of many important books on European history. In a statement written in 1969, Taylor summed up the injustice of the Hess case. Professor Taylor wrote, quote, "Hess came to this country in 1941 as an ambassador of peace. He came with the intention of restoring peace between Great Britain and Germany. He acted in good faith. He fell into our hands and was quite unjustly treated as a prisoner of war. After the war, we could have released him. No crime has ever been proven against Hess. As far as the records show, he was never at even one of the secret discussions at which Hitler explained his war plans. He was, of course, a leading member of the Nazi Party, but he was no more guilty than any other Nazi, or, if you wish, any other German. All the Nazis, all the Germans, were carrying on the war, but they were not all condemned because of this. That Rudolf Hess, the only one at Nuremberg who had risked his life for peace, was found guilty of crimes against peace, was certainly the tribunal's most ironic perversion of justice." Unquote. After his sentencing, Rudolf Hess spent the years from 1947 until his death in 1987 in West Berlin's Spandau prison, which was run by the four Allied powers. The regulations of the prison stipulated that, quote, "imprisonment will be in the form of solitary confinement," unquote, and forbade prison officials to ever call Hess by his name. He was addressed only as Prisoner Number 7. Conditions for prisoners held in Spandau were so bad that French chaplain Pastor Cassalis protested to the prison directorate in 1950 with these words, "It can safely be said that Spandau has become a place of mental torture to an extent that does not permit the Christian conscience to remain silent." Unquote. For 20 years, Hess at least had the limited company of a few other Nuremberg defendants, but from October 1966 until his death 21 years later, Hess was the only inmate in the fortress-like prison, which originally had been built to hold 600. Hess was, in the words of Spandau's American director, Lieutenant Colonel Eugene Byrd, the loneliest man in the world. Keeping this one man, Rudolf Hess, in Spandau cost the West German government about 850,000 marks a year. In addition, each of the four Allied powers had to provide an officer and 37 soldiers during their respective shifts, as well as a director and teams of warders throughout the entire year. The permanent maintenance staff of 22 included cooks, waitresses, and cleaners. In the final years of his life, Hess was a weak and frail old man, blind in one eye, who walked stooped forward with a cane. He lived in virtually total isolation, according to a strictly regulated daily routine. During his rare meetings with his wife and son, he was not allowed to embrace or even to touch them. Long before his death, Hess's imprisonment had been a grotesque and absurd spectacle. Even Winston Churchill expressed regret over his treatment. In 1950, he wrote, quote, "Reflecting upon the whole of the story, I am glad not to be responsible for the way in which Hess has been and is being treated. Whatever may be the moral guilt of a German who stood near to Hitler, Hess had, in my view, atoned for this by his completely devoted and frantic deed of lunatic benevolence. He came to us of his own free will, and though without authority, had something of the quality of an envoy. He was a medical and not a criminal case, and should be so regarded." Unquote. Sir Hartley Shawcross, who had been Britain's chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, said in a commented on the Hess case in an interview in 1977, and he called the continued imprisonment of Hess a scandal. The injustice against Rudolf Hess was not something that happened once and was quickly over. It was rather a wrong that went on day after day for 46 years. Rudolf Hess was, in truth, a prisoner of peace and a victim of a vindictive age. When Rudolf Hess died in 1987, I wrote a short letter to the New York Times about the Hess case. As far as I know, it's the only thing to appear in print in any major American periodical that made the point that Hess was a prisoner of peace and that the treatment of him was a rank injustice. In fact, the letter prompted criticism by people who didn't answer what I actually had to say and write in my letter, but who attacked me for having written it. The Hess case points up and underscores the tremendous double standard that prevails in our society about history and about historical figures. In our society, in the United States and Western Europe, people are free and even encouraged to wear T-shirts with pictures on them of people like Che Guevara or Pancho Villa or Emilio Zapata, people who were bandits or criminals of one kind or another. Rudolf Hess was not a bandit or a criminal. He was a man of peace, the only one, as I mentioned, the only leading figure of any of the major country powers in World War II that actually risked his life and tried to do something bold to try to end the war. But in America today and in Western Europe and in Germany, there is tremendous fear of the legacy of Rudolf Hess because of the blatant injustice against him is in points up so markedly the double standard in our society. A double standard that, above all, is based on a sensibility and a concern about what Jewish Zionist groups consider important or not important. What I mean by this is that Rudolf Hess, or honoring his memory, is considered a terrible thing in America or Germany today, not because of anything he did or because the regime he was associated with is any worse than that of other regimes, which there's no particular bad reputation for honoring today, but because the Third Reich is so hated and detested, of course, by Israel and by Jewish organizations. What I mean by this is that even though the number of victims of the Soviet Union, especially under Stalin, or of the communist regime in China under Mao Zedong vastly overshadows and outnumbers the victims of the National Socialist regime in Germany, there is no particular downside to honoring or remembering Soviet or Marxist leaders. In fact, in Germany, the Social Democratic Party, through a foundation it controls, maintains the birthhouse of Karl Marx as a museum and shrine in the city of Trier in western Germany. But nobody going to Trier, or nobody who considers the legacy of Karl Marx, seriously thinks that there's any likelihood that visiting the birthhouse of Karl Marx or keeping his birthhouse as a museum or shrine is going to lead to any revival of of communism or Marxism. In London, the gravesite of Karl Marx is still maintained as a kind of shrine with a large bust of the head of Karl Marx on a gravestone with the words, "Workers of all countries, unite." In China, the body of Mao Zedong is still on display, embalmed in China. But nobody particularly objects to that. But Jewish organizations complain about any remembrance or memory of leaders of the National Socialist regime because in our society, in the United States and in West Germany, Jewish Zionist interests and sensibilities have a greater priority than those of than any other, and serve as a kind of litmus test for what's permissible or not permissible in our society. It's astonishing that 24 years after his death, and so many years after his lifetime during the Third Reich, that Rudolf Hess's legacy should be as potent and as powerful as it still is. In fact, I think it's safe to say that in an age in which Marxism and the Soviet system and the Marxist system has been discredited, and I think is a thing of the past forever, and during a time in which the liberal democratic system is undergoing a tremendous crisis, the history and the legacy of the Third Reich is all the more interesting to people given the age in which we live. And the memory of Rudolf Hess, particularly as a man of unquestioned courage and bravery in risking his life for peace, stands out in the age in which we live. In the next part of this broadcast, I want to talk about a book that has just recently been published, a new book entitled Why Leaders Lie, a book written by the American historian John Mearsheimer, who, along with Stephen Walt, is the author of the important book The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which caused a tremendous stir several years ago when it was issued, for laying out in great detail the enormous power of the Jewish Zionist lobby here in the United States. Well, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, the co-authors of the book, both eminent historians and specialists of diplomatic history, have maintained their reputations in spite of the tremendous amount of calumny and criticism they received for writing this book on Israel and U.S. foreign policy. But the new book by John Mearsheimer, Why Leaders Lie, is particularly interesting because a central thesis of his book, a central point of his book, I'm basing this on reviews I've read of the book, and not of the book itself, which I hope to read soon. A major point he makes is that the tendency to deceive the public, to lie to the public about foreign policy and especially about war, is greater in a democratic society than it is in other forms of society, because the only way to prod the public into supporting war is by trying to convince the public that it's necessary to go to war because the enemy is so dangerous that he can't be allowed to stay in place, and that the enemy is so evil and so dangerous that he has to be done away with. The result of this, as Mearsheimer explains in his book, is that democratic leaders and leaders in the United States particularly tremendously exaggerate during campaigns to get support for war about the alleged dangers to the American public. And Mearsheimer, in his book, cites numerous examples of this throughout history. He cites, for example, during the Vietnam War, the deceit of the Lyndon Johnson administration, which he engineered to persuade the U.S. Congress to pass the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, authorizing unlimited military force by the United States and by the White House to fight what was called aggression by North Vietnam. But Mearsheimer cites more than that. Of course, he emphasizes the tremendous deceit of the administration of George W. Bush in trying to generate support for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2001. And the statements by Bush, by Vice President Cheney, and by others in the administration that were completely untrue, false statements about alleged ties between Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq and al-Qaeda, about alleged weapons of mass destruction or even a nuclear weapons program, and other claims which were false but which the Bush administration felt was necessary to persuade or deceive the American public into supporting the U.S. bombing, invasion, and occupation of Iraq. But more interestingly, perhaps, Mearsheimer also discusses how President Roosevelt also lied and deceived the American public in 1941 about Germany's alleged plans to dominate and take over the world, about an alleged danger posed by Germany to the United States, that President Roosevelt cited and invented in order to persuade the American public to support his measures to get the United States into war against Germany. Mearsheimer's book is an important one because he's a respected American historian today. But the points he's making in his book, again, I'm basing this on reviews, are not at all new. In fact, the British historian F.J.P. Veal made many of the same points in his book, Advance to Barbarism, which was published first in 1948 and then in 1953 and then during the 1960s. He made exactly the same point that democratic societies, because they require mass support for their policies, are much more apt to engage in lies, exaggeration, and deceit to whip up support for war than are political systems and other forms of society. But the implications of what Mearsheimer has to say go beyond foreign policy, because the same pattern of deceit is also true in domestic policy as well. Political leaders routinely exaggerate the situation, the danger, and exaggerate what they're able to do to try to whip up support. The end result of all of this over a period of time is to create tremendous distrust of the public, not for one leader or this leader or that leader or this party or for that party, but for the entire political system. And I'm bringing this up now because this is particularly relevant as the public is increasingly disillusioned and fed up with the inability of the political leaders in Washington to come to an agreement about the budget and about the debt ceiling. The United States is has essentially maxed out its credit card. And the political leaders engage in a partisan political game to increase their own standing and their own agenda of their own party at the cost of what's good for the country as a whole. But this tendency of democratic societies is based on an essential weakness of the democratic system. The weakness is that the public prefers time and again agreeable lies and deceit to hard reality and uncomfortable, unpleasant truths. The political leader who's most likely to get elected and reelected is the political leader who tells the public what they want to hear rather than what the truth is. The result of this is to increasingly, in our society, bring leaders into office who postpone problems, put them off, and shove them off in responsibility to new generations. And the problems that John Mearsheimer talks about in his latest book, Why Do Leaders Lie About Foreign Policy, is only an aspect of a larger problem about the liberal democratic system, which is requires that leaders deceive the public in order to get elected. This is a fatal flaw that's going to be more and more acute, more and more obvious with each passing year as the problems that we that are looming in America based on postponing hard decisions about what must be done. As this becomes more and more acute, these problems will grow, and the essential inherent problems and weaknesses of a liberal democratic society are going to be ever more obvious. And I'll return, just as I've dealt with this problem in the past in talking about foreign policy, I'm going to be talking about this in future broadcasts because it's one that has relevance for all of us today. This is particularly acute when it comes to the U.S. relationship with Israel in the Middle East, in which through propaganda, politicians who are beholden to the powerful Jewish lobby in this country tell the public lies about America's relationship with Israel and the U.S. relationship with the rest of the world, and particularly the Arab countries and Muslim countries, in order to get reelected. The result is that they put their partisan interests ahead of the interests of the American people and of humanity. And this is an increasingly great problem and a level of and a weakness and a level of hypocrisy that much of the world understands and increasingly grasps, even if the American public still hasn't understood this yet. The sad fact is that these problems are so ingrained in the American political system that almost certainly it will require a very, very harsh and sobering experience to change things in any fundamental way. And the current paralysis in Washington by the leaders of both parties over the national budget and the debate over the national debt ceiling is only the current manifestation of this fundamental problem. I urge you to write to me about comments or suggestions for future broadcasts and to check out the IHR website and support the IHR with your donations. And I hope you'll join me for the next broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.